You're listening to episode 10 of season 8 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order, and this show usually talks about all kinds of technical stuff, Unix and Linux and BSD, well, BSD I haven't mentioned in ages, but anyway, technical stuff. This episode, I'm afraid, I really have kind of, I feel like I've kind of run out of topics to really discuss, so I was going to maybe start to transition the show into something a little bit more, maybe a little bit more about business presentations, spreadsheets, making your slideshow presentations more powerful with clever graphics from the internet that you can use to make people laugh, to drive home points better, and snazzy transitions and sound effects and things like that. So I don't know if that's going to be of interest to you. I think it probably will. I'm sure it'll be very interesting. So if you just want to open up LibreOffice spreadsheet, we'll get started with cell A in column A, row A, and we'll work our way through down to row AA. One by one. So let's make a sample presentation. Oh, this is actually really embarrassing. I'm getting a phone call. Let me just answer that really quick. Don't go anywhere. Oh my gosh, I can't believe this. This is really exciting. By pure chance, Reggie, the multimedia artist, Linux geek, creator of all kinds of art and geek art and technological wonderment, is on my phone right now. I'm going to pipe her in, and looks like we've got something to talk about after all on this episode. Reggie, you're my new favorite artist. How do you describe yourself? What are you?
Thanks. I'm a freelance creator of Miscellanea. So I do writing and art and computer stuff and video, just whatever creative project I feel like doing, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I came across you online initially for technical writing, like literally like an article, both on Make Tech Easier and Linux Journal. And I'm curious as to how you got into technical writing.
I'm not exactly sure how. I think with Linux Journal, I think I was maybe reading a Linux Journal article, and then I noticed there was a section on their site that said write for us, and I was like, huh, I could do that. I have article ideas. So I got involved with that first, and then so I wrote a couple articles for Linux Journal. One of them was on console music players. The other one was on video art in Linux. And since then, I've broadened my horizons when it comes to like who I'm writing for. So I've gone out of my way to find other places I could write for. Like I've Google searched the phrase Linux write for us. And so I think that might be how I found Make Tech Easier, but I had already heard of Make Tech Easier before I applied for them in any case. So I was either reading the site or searched for that phrase and found it. But yeah, I thought like, oh, this would be a great place to write for. I could probably regularly submit articles to them that they would find interesting.
I think that the idea of an artist who is also a geek, whatever geek means these days, I think it's still pretty unique. So how did you get, were you an artist first and then a geek? Were you a geek and then an artist, or both, or what?
I started out as an artist. Like, I've been into art since I was a little kid. I would write picture books when I was, like, 4 or 5, and I've just been into comics and visual art and writing and all that since I was really young. And I didn't get into the geek thing until maybe around, like, 2007 or 2008, when I had a Mac computer, and I had basically grown up with Windows computers until a certain point in college when I got a MacBook, or an iBook, actually. But then I started getting really into the terminal, and through using the Unix terminal in OS X, I eventually got into Linux.
That's really funny, because that is exactly how I got into Unix.
Yeah, you're the only other person I know who has that experience.
Yeah, likewise. It feels kind of like the term geek is a little bit maybe distilled lately. Like nowadays, you're sort of a geek if you, I don't know, have a Twitter account. You know, I mean, do you feel that way? Or and do we need a new term for what a geek is?
I know what you're talking about, but I don't know, it kind of reminds me of how the word hacker has changed over time. People who tweak their computers, like basically a geek, and now it means, you know, like black hat hackers, or like there's a more prominent cultural stereotype than there was before. And with geek, yeah, I think the term geek has been mainstreamified recently. So, yeah, I agree with you. Like, I don't think that a true geek is really someone who uses Twitter, but in popular culture, that does seem to be what it means.
But you are, I guess, a true geek, because you have even made your own Arch spin, or whatever they call it in the Arch world, and you call it SadOS, which I think is hilarious. Can you tell me a little bit about what this distribution is all about?
Well, SadOS came out as a promotional thing, actually, for my webcomic, because I was exhibiting my comics at APE, the Alternative Press Expo in San Francisco, which is a really cool alternative comics expo. If you're into indie alternative comics, you should totally check it out. But anyway, I wanted to have some cool things to sell there, so I decided that I would make the operating system from my fictional webcomic into a real operating system and sell it on thumb drives. And the comic is about a depressed guy, so I thought it was appropriate to call the operating system that he used SadOS. And this is going back to when I first started the comic and first decided to give him his own operating system to use before it was a real thing or anything. I had no idea, by the way, that GLaDOS was a thing until much later. I was pleased to find that out. But I took the idea of SadOS, I turned it into a distro first using SUSE Studio to make an open SUSE-based distro, but that didn't work out too well. So I switched to making an Ubuntu-based distro using the tool Remaster Sys for taking a pre-existing Linux installation and turning it into a live CD that's also installable. Remaster Sys is a great tool for that. It's graphical. It's very easy to use. That was SadOS 0.9 that I made based on Xubuntu with Remaster Sys, and I sold that on thumb drives at APE. And then afterwards, I decided that I didn't really want SadOS to be based on Ubuntu, and I just didn't feel right about it. I didn't think my webcomic character was the type of guy who'd use Ubuntu. So... So then I was looking into how to make live CDs off of other distros. What I really wanted was to do it off of Gentoo, because that's the distro that I use. But I couldn't find a simple way to do that. There is some tool, actually, for making Sabion spins called Molecule. And I didn't try that, but that perhaps if I want to make a Gentoo-based distro, I'll try doing it with Molecule. But anyway, I found this program for Arch Linux called Larch, which supposedly is kind of the same as Remaster Sys for Ubuntu. And, I should mention that Remaster Sys also works on Debian-based systems, but I happen to use it on Xubuntu. But anyway, with Arch, I tried Larch, and it didn't work. I contacted the developer, and he said that he wasn't actively developing it anymore, and that it probably wasn't compatible with the latest versions of Arch. So then I discovered Arch ISO, partly because I posted on Reddit, actually asking for any tips about using Larch, and then someone just recommended Arch ISO, so I thought, oh, okay, this is what, I guess some official people have used it to make Arch-based distros, so it's the tool of choice, and there's a whole page on the Arch Wiki about it, and I actually just wrote an article on using Arch ISO for a Linux magazine. But yeah, that's the tool I ended up using to make SadOS 1.0, which is based on Arch. And that worked out pretty well. And as far as what the operating system is all about, other than it being sort of a promotional thing for my webcomic, it's also, I've described it as basically a distribution for artsy hackers. And it has a lot of hacking and security tools. It also has graphics tools, like various fractal tools, like let's see, like Fire, Xaos, different things like that, like more unconventional graphics programs, I guess. And of course, it has the GIMP, things like that.
So you kind of pre-install a bunch of artsy programs, and that's kind of what SadOS is geared towards?
Yes, and security programs too, many of which I don't actually know how to use myself.
Nice. How did you get into Gentoo then? Because that seems like a really, I don't know, sort of hardcore distribution.
Well, as I started getting into Linux, it was through virtual machines on my Mac, and Sabion was one of the distros that I was testing. Also, at that time, I was testing Mandriva and a couple others. I had like 20 virtual machines at one time. I don't even remember which ones they were, but Sabion was the one that I ended up liking the best, and so I eventually dual-booted on my computer with Sabion, and then I got another computer, a PC, onto which I also installed Sabion, because that was my distro of choice at the time, and this was about a year ago, maybe, and then I ended up having some problems with my Sabion installation, and I had this friend, Phil, who's super into Gentoo, and I was asking him what to do about my problems, what I think it was first it was something with Wi-Fi not working, and then it was something else. It was kind of just a string of problems that came up in a very short period. And he was like, well, your problem is that you're running Sabion. You're not just running pure Gentoo, so you should do that. And he managed to convince me to wipe my Sabion installation and do a Gentoo installation. And this is my first time doing a Gentoo installation. I've since managed to install it on my own computer without the help of Phil when I got another computer. But yeah, I just got pretty comfortable with Gentoo. I like Emerge, and it's got a lot of up-to-date packages and stuff. That's really important to me in a distro, is that it's bleeding edge. So yeah, I've just gotten comfortable with Gentoo, and I really like using it now.
Is the install of Gentoo sort of as bad as its reputation has it be?
It takes a few hours, but let's see, I've done it 3 times total. The first time was with my friend Phil on my computer. The second time was in a virtual machine to prepare myself for actually installing it on my new computer.
That's smart.
Yeah, so that actually, that experience helped a lot. It's basically all on the Gentoo, in the Gentoo handbook, so it's not as intimidating as it probably once was because it's so well documented. So if you have another device or computer on hand which you can use to reference the manual, it's actually not that bad. But you do have to be a little comfortable with the command line to do it. I would say it's comparable to an Arch install in terms of difficulty.
Okay, well, I've never done an Arch install either. You really like the cutting edge stuff. Do you find that that's something that you can actually use for artwork? I mean, I guess it is, because you do, but is it not a problem for you ever?
Sometimes packages won't install because they're masked for various reasons. Usually I just have to change the use flags or the keywords in order to get packages to install when they're being pesky like that. But I've had issues where some packages just don't install, or there's conflicting dependencies, things like that. They're not too frequent, though. Usually I have success with installing packages, and I haven't had any serious system breakdowns or anything. So, like, I know that it's probably not the best choice for a server, but for my use, for desktop use, I think it's great. It's stable as I need it to be.
Okay, that's cool. Okay, so if you had, I don't know, your own virtual studio, didn't have to work, didn't have to do anything, what would be the go-to apps for you in terms of creating art and stuff like that? Like, what are the things that you just love in Gentoo and SatOS and whatever?
Well, definitely the GIMP and Inkscape. Those are old standbys. I couldn't get rid of those. Other things that I depend on for daily use, I use Vim for text editing a lot. I use Tomboy Notes just for keeping track of my notes, though lately I've been having some trouble with Tomboy Notes synchronization feature, so I've been using Gnote instead. But let's see, that's kind of besides the point of creating art. I use Mandelbulber for creating 3D fractal art sometimes. I use...
That's cool.
Dia, the diagram editor. Haven't used that one in a while, but I do always install it on a system just to have it. MyPaint, and I use GwenView for simple image viewing, resizing, cropping, stuff like that. I use Xane for scanning. MakeHuman, occasionally I use for making 3D human models. Like about a year or so ago, I was dabbling in a lot of 3D stuff. I'm not an expert in 3D by any means, but I was playing around with making 3D images. So MakeHuman was, I think I showed you a video that I made where I used MakeHuman models.
Yeah, and it looked great, and I'd never heard of MakeHuman. So talk about that a little bit. It's because I still haven't actually looked at it. I haven't launched it. I went to the website. How does it differ from Blender, I guess, would be the question that I would ask.
Oh, well, it has pretty much one purpose, unlike Blender. Like, the purpose of MakeHuman is to make a 3D human model. So you can't animate it from MakeHuman. You can render a two-dimensional image of it, and you can export it as a 3D model in various formats, but you can't do nearly as much as you can do in Blender. It's not a full-featured 3D animation or rendering suite by any means.
And so why would I use it? Why does it exist? Just as an alternative, or is it noticeably easier than Blender to do the modeling?
It is certainly easier than Blender for modeling because it gives you basically a human prototype, and then you can adjust parameters with sliders to change the appearance of the model and add hair, things like that. I've had mixed results with trying to add hair, so I usually don't. It's still an alpha phase, by the way.
Okay.
It's more comparable to Poser than to Blender.
Okay. Some of the art on your website is really, really kind of far out and cool.
Thanks.
What are some of the, like, there's this whole screenshot area of your, no, I don't think it is the screenshot that I'm thinking of. There's some stuff that I guess you describe as
Sorry, can you repeat that? I didn't hear you. You glitched.
Oh, I glitched. I said that there's a section in there that you call, like, glitch art. I don't know where it is right
glitches,
now.
Glitches, errors, and screens of death.
Is that what it is? I can't find it right now. But yes.
Yeah, it's on the left sidebar. Yes.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So how do you do, like, this glitch stuff? I mean, without giving any of your, you know, private artistic secrets away.
Most of it's just things that I've encountered in daily life. I was going through a period where whenever I had an error on my computer, I would just take a screenshot of it, and if my whole computer was messed up and I couldn't get a screenshot, I would just take a photo of it with my phone. So a couple of those errors are from virtual machines. Quite a few of them are from my Mac. And then just various errors, like one of them is from a router, I believe. One of them is when someone died in a game. some of them, it looks like I've actually double-casted them on this website. They're Pauvre illustrations that I created just by messing around with the parameters in certain Pauvre sample files until I got something cool. So I counted those as glitch art just because it wasn't really intentional exactly, but it still ended up looking cool.
Can you talk a little bit about Pauvre? Because I know the name. I think a lot of people do, but I don't think many people really have a concept of what it is or what it looks like when you launch it. I mean, is it a GUI app at all?
There are front ends for it, but the executable Pauvre is a command line application. And so far, I haven't actually found a decent front end that will run on Linux. So for when I was on a Mac, I would use Megapov, which is a good one.
What about some of the sound stuff? I've heard not much of your sound work, but I've seen some of your videos with stuff that you've done sound in the background. Curious about some of your favorite sound applications.
Yeah, Audacity is my go-to sound application. I've also used Sox. What does Sox stand for? Sound Exchange?
I thought it was... Is that what it is? I don't know. I keep calling it the Swiss Army Knife of Sound, but I think that's just their tagline.
Yeah, it is the Swiss Army Knife of Sound. That it is. It's also Sound Exchange. So yeah, it's the SO and then the X in Exchange. So I've used that on the command line for warping stuff, adding a chorus effect. Haven't used that in a while though, so I can't actually quote you any particular commands that I've used for it.
That was my next question.
Yeah, I kind of thought it would be. Some of my videos, I just did the sound within the video editing application, and I know it might be inappropriate to say for this podcast, but I have used a lot of my videos.
Oh, don't worry, I'm bleeping that out.
Yeah, so I've used that mentionable application for that unmentionable operating system before for editing sound, and it's
good.
Actually pretty good for that.
It's horrible for sound. What are you talking
about?
Is
it? Well, I don't have the highest of expectations.
Every time someone edits sound in that application, I can hear it right away. Well, apparently not.
You couldn't tell that
I did
it.
Yeah, apparently not. But in everyone else's, I can tell.
I should have left that part a mystery.
Yeah. What about your ASCII art? You've got like right on your webpage, there's like, I guess, a picture of, I guess that's you in ASCII art. And then somewhere else, I think a movie that I saw, you convert yourself to ASCII video, which was really cool. What do you use for that stuff?
Yeah, for the image, I use JP2A, which is a command line image converter. Basically, it takes a JPEG and converts it to ASCII art, and it's very simple to use. For the video, I believe what I did, if it's the video that I'm thinking of, I used VLC to, or sorry, not VLC. You can do animated ASCII art in VLC, but...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's one of the optional outputs you can set it up for, but what I did was play the video in mPlayer using the libkaka output library. So what I did was type player-vo... Kaka, and then the name of the file, and I took a screen recording of that. And I also glitched out the video using hexadecimal editing.
What?
Yeah. I think we're talking about the same video.
That... Yeah, we are. But what does that mean? You say hexadecimal editing. I hear something in Greek.
Okay, so any file of any type you can open up in a hexadecimal editor, and there's various hexadecimal editors available for Linux, like HexCurse or GHex. So I used one of those, and I just basically changed random values that corresponded to different keyframes. I haven't been able to find a thorough reference of like how to interpret a certain type of video file in hexadecimal. Like I know they typically start with a header for the file. So when you go through when you open it in a hexadecimal editor and you go through the file, you'll see numbers and letters and random stuff. And in some hexadecimal editors, there's a side panel where it shows decimal version of it, plain text in the header sometimes. Like in an MP4, I think it shows plain text, something indicating that it's an MP4. But basically what I did, like, I just did find and replace a certain number of times. So I would change a certain sequence, like, say, 00000, which in hexadecimal means black. I would change that to FF0000, which would be red. And I would save the file and then play it back and see how it looked different. And if you mess around with the hexadecimal code too much, especially if you accidentally get into the header, you can mess up the file and make it unplayable. But if you do it just enough, you can make the file have some really cool glitch effects. And you can also use a tool called AviGlitch, which is a Ruby library, or it's a Ruby gem, and it has a command line tool called Datamosh that you can use to accomplish the data moshing effect, which was popularized by a Kanye West video, actually. I don't know which one it was, but it sort of hit the mainstream a little bit in the past couple years, but it's still a super cool effect. It's like, it makes it look like the video is kind of bleeding into itself, and it does that by deleting iframes.
Oh, nice.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did not use that tool for any of my videos, actually, but it's still out there, so I thought I would mention it.
Well, the other thing sounds amazing. I mean, that's just really cool. I've never messed around with hex editors or whatever, so that sounds really amazing.
Yeah, you can do it with sound files, too, and get some pretty hard-on-the-ears effects if you want to.
Yeah, I'll bet. I don't know if glitches really translates that well into sound in my experience so far.
You can get some cool effects with images, too.
Oh, okay.
And it's interesting how, like, different image files have... Some have easier-to-read hex formats. Like, for instance, I think it was a TIFF file that I messed with where each pixel is actually mapped out in the hexadecimal code. So you could just literally replace all the black with red using the example that I said earlier, because it's actually like the RGB, or the hexadecimal codes for the RGB notations are in there, like, exactly.
I wonder if that has anything to do with the fact that TIFF is not compressed, whereas, you know, like a JPEG would be, and obviously it would be harder to do something like that. I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Oh, that's very cool. It's funny, you know, I've looked at packets over the network and seen headers and things like that. I just never thought that the same would be true for images and videos and stuff. I mean, files on your computer.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, you can use for repairing files too sometimes, because sometimes if the header's broken somehow, you can actually open it in the hexadecimal editor and fix the header.
That's amazing.
Not that I know how to do that, but I know it can be done.
I mean, I would think it would be as easy as opening up a similar file and grabbing that header and, like, putting it into the broken one, but who knows?
Yeah, I think there's some variables that change, though, like, according to the length of the video and just various things like that.
Very cool, though. I'm going to mess around with some stuff like that. You know what that music means? It's time for a coffee break. So go grab yourself a cup, and you know, while you're at it, why not visit sados.sourceforge.net and download a copy of Reggie's very fine distro for artsy hackers. Okay, well, I hope you had a great cup of coffee. And during the coffee break, I got a lot of listener feedback asking you, Reggie, what coffee you drink.
Oh, wow. Well, I'm not too picky about the kind of coffee I drink. As long as it's not super watered down, I'll just drink whatever. I go with light roasts, usually, because they have more caffeine, so the more caffeine, the better.
Oh, okay.
How about you?
I'm a little bit of a light roast person myself. Maybe, I don't know, I think of it as a mild roast. Not too light, but I don't really like the dark stuff because I don't like that burnt taste.
Yeah.
How many cups would you say that you drink over the course of, say, a normal day?
My coffee consumption varies a lot. So, for instance, today I haven't had any coffee. Yesterday I had a 12-ounce cup.
Well, wait, because...
And some other days...
I mean, today you must have had coffee because we just had a coffee break. Surely you drank Oh, other than that, you meant.
Silly me. I completely forgot about our coffee break. That's right. Thanks for reminding me. But yeah, other days I'll drink like 6 cups. For instance, when I was living at my parents' place recently, my mom would brew a lot of coffee. So I drank a lot of coffee because it was around.
And how do you typically make your coffee? Do you do the whole drip thing or you percolator, espresso, French press?
I usually just buy my coffee at coffee shops. Otherwise, well, I don't have my own coffee maker right now, unfortunately, but the last coffee maker that I had regular access to was at my parents' house, and it was just a standard coffee maker. Occasionally, I would drink French press coffee, too. I like espresso as well.
Yeah, that's good stuff. How do you usually make your coffee, like a normal cup of coffee? Is it very strong? Is it very light?
I like it strong. Yeah, very strong.
You put any cream or sugar in it?
A little bit of cream, yeah. Half and half.
Cool. Sounds good. Sounds very interesting.
Yeah, it's quite interesting.
What about instant coffee? What are your feelings on instant coffee? And be careful here. This is a very touchy subject.
Yeah, sensitive listeners, beware. I don't have a very good opinion of instant coffee. I've never really had any instant coffee that's any good.
Yeah.
I was on a trip recently where I went to Israel, and we had a lot of instant coffee, and I gotta say, it sucks.
That is a weird thing. Have you noticed, or at least I've noticed, like if you go to a coffee shop, at least overseas, I'm speaking specifically of France because that's been my experience, but maybe it's other places too, and you ask for a coffee, they give you Nescafe, and it is instant coffee. It's really weird.
That's weird. I've been to Barcelona and Amsterdam, and I don't recall experiencing that. What I do recall, though, is that when I ordered a cup of coffee, they were significantly smaller than American cups of coffee.
I got into the habit of just asking for Cafe Americano, and that seemed to get, you know, like a normal size cup. And frankly, it's kind of better anyway, because it's basically just espresso with hot water. It's actually quite flavorful.
Yeah, I might have actually done that too when I was there. I don't remember, though. It was a while ago. But that sounds like a wise decision.
So when you were overseas, did you have any, I've heard it called two different things, like Greek coffee or Turkish coffee. I don't know, maybe it's other stuff. Have you had that? It's very finely ground. They just pour the hot water into it and you drink it and there's like all the mud still at the bottom.
Yeah, I'm quite a fan of Turkish coffee, actually. I've never heard it called Greek coffee before, but yeah.
You know where I heard that? It was when I was living in Astoria, which is the Greek neighborhood in Queens. They called it Greek coffee there, so maybe that was a bias.
But it was the same thing as Turkish coffee?
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing.
Did it have cardamom in it?
Oh, I don't know. What is that?
It's a spice. I think they usually put it in there.
I don't know. I mean, I can never read the packages.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Is that what's adding that interesting flavor? I guess maybe that is.
I think so.
Okay, I had no idea. Thank you. You've taught me something. Have you ever made it yourself?
No, I haven't. Have you?
Yeah, when I first got it, I tried making it myself. The first time I did horribly a bad job of it, but then I asked like my landlord how to do it, and he kind of showed me, and it's easy, but it's good.
Yeah, my mom makes it.
Does she have like the whole kit, like, you know, the little tiny pot that you're supposed to use, that whole thing, or does she just make it in a normal pan, like a saucepan?
That's a good question. I feel like she had the actual kit, though I'm not entirely sure on that. She hasn't made it in a while.
Well, maybe we could get your mom on here. Maybe she'd be a better person to talk to here.
I don't know about that.
Okay, well, so you're also you've also written some fiction, right? How much fiction have you written?
Mostly short stories. I haven't written fiction in a while. The last fiction I wrote was the book you read, The Isolated Clay, which is a short novelette, I guess you could call it. That was pretty much the most recent thing I've written and the longest. And other than that, my short stories are published in various places. I don't even know if those websites are still up anymore.
Yeah. Well, The Isolated Clay was amazing. That book really surprised me. It was just a really great little book and an easy read because it was short, so I keep telling people they should read it.
Oh, thanks.
What is The Isolated Clay about, in your opinion? Like, what's the point of that story?
It's basically about a guy who's felt like an outcast all of his life.
Gee, I wonder if any of my listeners would be able to identify with that. Go ahead.
So he's basically searching for the secret quality that successful people have that he has such a hard time comprehending, even coming close to. And this is in the wake of his wife leaving him. And he never really liked his wife that much in the first place, but now that she's left him, he feels rejected, and that's sort of opened up a whole world of wondering why he can't be successful like certain other people are. And he's a computer science teacher for high school kids. And so there's a couple different guinea pigs for his experiments. He starts out doing personality tests because he thinks that he can isolate that mysterious quality of success and just like getting it in life. He thinks that he can find that with personality testing. And so he administers the MBTI, the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, and the Enneagram, which is another popular personality test. These are actually real research tests. I didn't make them up. And then he finds that he doesn't learn as much about his subjects as he would like through the personality testing. So he creates a device. He creates a couple devices throughout the book, actually, but the main one is called the PTSD. It's the psychotransference selection device, and that is a chip that he can put in the proximity of a certain person to basically grab their thoughts onto the chip. So he puts that chip, or he can put that chip, like, on someone's sweater, for instance. Not that that necessarily happens in the book, I'm not going to say.
Oh, no, naturally.
and send that home with that person and then retrieve the chip the next day and find out what that person was thinking while he was wearing that sweater. Ultimately, what it comes down to is it's about his experiments just trying to isolate this mysterious quality in people, find out what it is because he's so curious and he feels so out of it.
It's amazing. It's an amazing story. But how deep into computers were you at the time? Because it surprised me. The book starts out kind of not very technical, at least not overtly, and then it starts to really play around with technology and ideas like that a geek really would kind of understand or kind of could understand in a speculative fiction setting. Were you really into it at that point?
Actually, no. I wrote this in about 2007. I didn't have it published until this past year, but at the time that I wrote it, I was, I think, just getting into technology. Like, I was at the level where I wrote the book in text edit on my Mac, so I at least knew not to use Microsoft Word for it, so yeah. I was that geeky, but I wasn't into Linux yet at the time. I was pretty much a noob.
You wouldn't know it from reading it. It sounds very authentic. I approve of the technology in there.
Thanks. I did do a lot of research on the, I think it was a G3, most of the computer stuff to place on. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it is. You're.
Yeah, so I did do some research on the G3s, and I believe that that's also the computers that were running in my high school classroom at the time, and so a lot of this was coming from my own experiences in high school with computer labs.
So what is your training? What's your education, rather? I mean, I know you went to art school, but what kind of major did you focus on?
Right. Well, I didn't technically go to art school. I went to UC Santa Cruz and majored in art. So I have a BA in art, and it's just art. But what I mainly focused on was drawing and painting at the time. I started doing a little bit of pre-computer-based art when I was in college around my senior year. I used pattern generators online to create different types of grids and patterns and print those out and make collage art. So that was, like, I guess just the very tip of the iceberg in the very beginning when it came to me using computers for my art.
Are you moving toward like an almost all computer workflow, or do you still do like a lot of physical art?
Lately, I've been mostly doing digital based art, and that's not to say that I'm never going to do material art again. I just haven't done it lately. I get really into things. I go through phases where I get obsessive about a certain topic or workflow or end creation. And so right now I'm sort of in a computer art phase, I guess. I don't know if it's going to be a phase or something that lasts for a long time. I have a feeling it's going to last for a long time, but I might go back to experimenting more with other materials. But yeah, lately it's been mostly digital.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a lot of room for kind of expansion and just kind of, like, you would never really be able to know everything that's possible with computer art, but maybe the same thing could be happen with material art, I don't know.
Yeah, I just find computer art more intriguing at the moment. And maybe that's because I've sort of lost a bit of my skills since college. Like, I was a pretty good illustrator when I was in college, but just due to lack of practice, I guess, I'm kind of not as good anymore, I have to admit. So it's more pleasing to me to do things digitally and to edit things digitally, and I end up with a final product that I like a little more. Like, I use pretty much an entirely digital workflow for my webcomic, which sometimes I'll draw out sketches on paper, and then I'll scan them or take a photo of them and use them as references, but for the most part, I use a digital workflow.
Now, when you say reference, do you mean, like, that you literally trace over your sketches, or is it more of, like, you just have it up on the screen and then kind of copy it?
A little of both. If I really like the sketch, I'll trace over it with my tablet. If not, then I'll just have it on the screen.
Okay, so you do use a tablet for your illustrations.
Yes. I'm not, like, super good with a tablet. It's still a little awkward for me. I have a Wacom Intuos 5. It's a pretty good one. I guess it's just the easiest way to get it onto the computer. And yeah. I like the pressure sensitivity. I like using it in different programs like MyPaint because it looks really nice, and it's nicer than any of the pens that I have.
Yeah, how does MyPaint stack up against, I guess, other tools out there for an illustrator?
Well, it's great for doing, like, drafts of things or for doing parts of drawings, but it's by no means a full-featured image editor. So it doesn't have, like, you can't crop. It has an infinite canvas. You can't, there's no fuzzy selection tool. There's no copy and paste or anything. So it's pretty limited to just a drawing tool. And I've read that the developers want to keep it that way, which is a little disappointing because I would like to use it as a full-featured image editing tool. But for the most part, when I'm making webcomic art on Linux, I use MyPaint and GIMP as well. GIMP for all the layers and the text and stuff.
Interesting. So they kind of have it. I mean, is that what they expect you to do? Sort of like do your drawing in MyPaint and then take it out to GIMP to, I guess, finish it?
I think that's the idea, yeah. I mean, you can make, I believe, like, finished works of art in MyPaint as long as you're pretty precise and you don't have a need to copy and paste or cut and paste. And I always do. Yeah. I'm always moving things around. So it's just not, like, especially for the webcomic workflow, it's not exactly the best tool, like, for a final product because you can't do text in it or anything, and you can't, like, really the, you can do layers, but it's limiting.
But you do your own font, I happen to know.
Yes, I do. It's my handwriting font. I actually made it on a PC in a program that I can't remember the name of. It was, I believe it was My Font Tool, which I've since tried downloading because I have a Windows dual boot set up, so I wanted to make a new font in that same program, and I tried downloading it, but it said it was only for tablet PCs, so I'm not sure why.
What is a tablet PC?
I guess a touch screen PC or something.
Wow, that's weird.
I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that's the tool that I originally used, and I used it on a regular PC, but I have not since been able to download it. So it's kind of disappointing because I can't find another program that lets me make a font just like by using my tablet to draw the letters out. Like, most of the font editors, like FontForge that I found, are more geared towards making vector images for the letters.
Right.
But I haven't found one that just has a straight up drawing tool. And I could be wrong about FontForge. Maybe there's a way to do it that I just haven't heard of. But I haven't been able to find it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, there might be a way to import stuff, maybe. Like, if you drew it out on Inkscape or something and then imported that into FontForge, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think, yeah, you're right about that.
So you don't, I mean, because all I ever hear about font design is, like, oh, you've got to do it really exactly. You've got to worry about the leading and the kerning and how they'll react to each other. You don't do that, right? You just threw some letters in there and made it a font.
Yeah, I changed the, when you draw the letters in, there's a little box, and so I changed the positioning of some of the letters, but I did not get obsessive or anything about the kerning and all that.
Well, your work is pretty amazing. I mean, the more I look at it, the more amazed I am by the amount of work, the variety of work that you've got, and I guess I'm just never quite satisfied with, like, the how and the why. So how did you get into the computer stuff? I mean, how did you start exploring, like, all of these different tools that you're now using and seem to be pretty darn good at? Like, how would people start getting into it?
Well, I was a total software whore for a while, where I would just download and download and download, like, so many different programs. I was just, like, basically like right around the time that I discovered free and open source software, I was like, oh my God, there's this whole world of free software that I can just get. And so I would get it and I would find like any cool graphics program that I could possibly discover on like CNET or Softpedia, places like that. And yeah, so keep in mind, I started out on a Mac, so I wasn't like searching repositories, though I did eventually use Mac ports to find Unix graphics tools too. But I basically just grabbed everything I could get and did weird things in them. So
that's cool.
A lot of it's experimentation.
Just playing around.
Yeah.
If people want to hear or find more out about you, well, let's take that in order, actually. So if people want to hear more about what you're doing, you do have a podcast, although you seem to never fully admit it.
Well, yeah, I insist that it's still in the alpha phase because...
When is it going to be out of alpha, though? Like, what's the... When do we know when it's safe?
I guess it's safe. I just... some of the early episodes are just me talking about random stuff. It doesn't really have that much of a focus yet. I think I'm going to move it more towards a tech focus, but I still...
Well, originally, it was supposed to be a podcast about a podcast... About making a podcast or something like that, right?
Right. It's called the Meta Podcast. It's currently called the podcast that's no longer about making a podcast.
Which is strangely meta in its own...
Yeah. But it was called the podcast about making a podcast because I was writing an article about podcasting tips. And so I wanted to do some demos to show what a podcast could sound like with various settings changed. Like, for instance, I used my computer's built-in microphone for my ThinkPad for one episode. I believe that was the first episode, just to show what the recording sounded like in comparison to a recording with my Blue Snowflake USB microphone, which sounded better.
Yeah, which I was amazed at. I mean, you could really hear the difference, and I guess I should have known that you would be able to hear the difference, but I was really kind of surprised at how different it was.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I made me glad about my purchase of the USB microphone. So yeah, the other episodes, I talk about the TV show Catfish. I talk about Dan Savage, he's also a podcaster, and the band Korn, which I should be embarrassed about. But then after that, it gets more into tech stuff and freelance writing related stuff. So that podcast is available at podcast.regic.net, and Regic is spelled R-U-J-I-C, so podcast.regic.net.
And what about other stuff online, like your artwork? Where would you send people first if they wanted to get started on Regic's portfolio?
Well, the portal site to everything is regic.net. And in there's a link to the obscenely long URL, supposedly .regic.net/lookwhatican-do. And that's where you can find most of my traditional art and some digital pictures. You can find my glitch photos there. I've also got a webcomic, the one that I was mentioning earlier, dondepresso.regic.net. And that's kind of the main project I'm working on right now. And you can find my writing at maketecheasier.com too, and various other places, but that's the main place I'm writing for at the moment.
Where are the easiest places for people to purchase hard copies of both the Isolated Clay and the Don DePresso?
There's a couple places you can go. I mean, you can just do a search online and easily find them, but Amazon.com is probably the easiest way to do it. And you can get ebook versions too.
Those are really nice, the hard copies. I was really impressed with, I guess, like the cover design and just, I mean, I don't know, it's cool to see anything in print, but it looked like a real book. How did you do all of that stuff?
Oh, well, for the Isolated Clay, I wish there was a way to convey what an image looks like through a podcast, but the cover, it has like a circuit board design, and there's a guy on a computer in front of it. So the way I did that was I used Eagle, the CAD program, to make the circuit board. I didn't actually make circuit board myself. It was a sample board for, I think, an Arduino board, and I exported it into an image. I changed some of the colors in GIMP, I believe, and I created the guy on the computer by taking two stock images, which I then traced over, made them into a silhouette. I traced over them using my tablet, I think, in either MyPaint or possibly Photoshop. And then I superimposed it on top of the circuit board, and I might have done the final design in InDesign, not sure about that. And then for Don DePresso, that was all Photoshop that I did that in. Oh, and the interior of the book I did in InDesign. I would use Scribus if I knew how to use it, but I was in a hurry to get this book done for the comics convention, so I just used the tool that was at hand and that I knew how to use, which was InDesign. And I exported it to a PDF, and I used CreateSpace. for distributing both of these books, which is an Amazon company. It's a print-on-demand thing. So I just sent them the PDF and told them to make a book, and that's how it worked.
Cool. Yeah, they came out great. I highly recommend them both. Okay, well, I think that... Oh, yeah, what did you do your design in, your web design? Because it looks horrible.
I originally did it... I changed it recently. I originally did it in SeaMonkey's Composer application.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then just a month or so ago, I changed it, and I did it in Composer. So, yeah, I would not have been able to hand code all those crazy HTML tables. So I used a GUI editor.
But you're running something on, like, Pi... What is it called? PyWigo? PyWigo?
PyWigo, yeah. My portfolio site is running on PyWigo.
That's so cool. So you just set that up. I mean, again, I just don't understand how you're doing all this stuff.
So my domain name is regic.net. I have, I think, unlimited subdomains. So I've just made subdomains for various purposes, and I downloaded the PyWigo installer, uploaded it to supposedly.regic.net, told it to install into the directory, look what I can do, and edited the theme by hand. It was a pre-built HTML-based or CSS-based theme that I just changed some things around in, like, the borders and stuff to make them look all old school.
Yeah, it looks good.
Thanks.
I love it. Cool. Okay, I think we've probably covered, like, everything you've ever done. So thank you very much for coming onto the show. I really appreciate it. Love hearing about people doing both techie stuff and artistic stuff. So thank you very much.
Cool. Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Are you?